Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. This week, we have two sponsors. One is Converge SE. It's this amazing conference in Columbia, South Carolina, coming up this April 25th through 27th. I'll be there, so check it out at convergese.com. We'll tell you a little bit more about it later in the show. And also our longtime sponsor, Environments for Humans, who have a summit, an online summit called the Responsive Web Design Summit, coming up here April 16th through 18th. So it's a conference that with the best of the best that you can attend online. Check that out, April 16th through 18th at rwdsummit.com. Well, again, we'll tell you a little bit more about that later in the show, but for now, let's kick things off. Hello and welcome to the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end-ish web design and development. This is episode something or other, 59, and I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hi, everybody. And today we have with us Laura Swanson. Hi, Laura.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm a little avid. I might be over soundboarding today, and I don't care.
Bring it.
Awesome. Keep going.
So, Laura, you work at Etsy, yeah?
I do indeed. I'm the engineering manager of the mobile web team.
Engineering manager of mobile web. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. So, what does mobile web for Etsy mean? Is there kind of a separate mobile website for Etsy?
So we actually have a mobile app team working on iOS and Android apps. And then we've got the mobile web team responsible for when, you know, handsets, tablets, et cetera, access the website.
Are they out? Cool. Is there like an Android and iOS app for Etsy? I don't even know.
Indeed, there are.
Even though I'm an iPad super fan. Oh, really? And it's separate? Yeah. It's like a separate code base and everything?
I'm not sure how
that works.
We all sit in the same room, which is awesome because, you know, all of our work really informs each other. So it's a pretty cool collaboration.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah. If I go to Etsy.com right now, which I am, and I visit the homepage of the website, I know you're new there, right? So you don't have like every answer of everything that I'm going to probably ask you. But
you're correct.
It's like not a responsive site, right? But maybe it doesn't need to be because there's so many other options for viewing Etsy content on all those other devices.
That's exactly the question that we're asking right now. We actually just had Brad Frost here 2 days ago to talk to us for an entire day about responsive web design strategy. Right now, what we're doing is we're sniffing user agents and delivering a different mobile template. But soon we're going to start talking about how responsive web can start to integrate with that.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Because it's always kind of like every single person who's ever user agent sniffs feels a little weird about it. it's often it's just going to get worse. In the history of it sucks and whatever. But it is a solution. Now we do it at CodePen. There's like 90% of the top websites in the world use UA sniffing of some kind. Did you use any of it on Microsoft, Dave? Or is that like a secret?
I could not tell you to view a little source. no, there's actually, I think it's totally public, but you might remember that Windows Phone font stuff that like it did it. Positives for font face and modernizer, but it actually doesn't support font face except from like a local font that's on like older Windows phones. And then stuff like if you specify a local source for Android Silk, the like Kindle Fire browser, if you specify like local smiley face, it'll fail on web fonts. So that's cool fact. So you have to like sniff there.
But you don't. But in the case of Etsy, they use their agent sniff and then serve an entirely different website.
We've got a different template. Yep, exactly.
Yeah, different template. Yeah, maybe the same code base, whatever, but it's a different. Yeah. That's, interesting. Okay, so I wonder what Brad Frost said. It would be funny to be behind that star. Was he like, you're doing it wrong? Or was he?
No, he was so impressive. He talked to us for the entire day and was just amazing. And then we had an event open to the public in the evening that we do regularly. It's called Code is Craft, where we bring in speakers to talk, and they're always awesome. And Brad basically did an entire day on responsive web design and processes and pitfalls and, you know, stuff that we can integrate. And it was just awesome.
That is awesome. Everybody, yeah. You should hire Brad Frost to come to your company.
Absolutely.
Because he's recently just gone off on his own. He was at, I don't know, some fancy New York agency, RGA, right?
RGA,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So now he's off on his own, and he needs people to hire him to do stuff. And clearly, look at this stunning recommendation that he does a good job when he comes to your company. So
yep,
he's a past guest of Shop Talk Show. That's great. Okay, cool. So that's Etsy, and you're new there, but you were at Dyn before that, DYN.com.
I was, yeah. I was the user experience manager, so I led a team of back-end and front-end developers to make their different applications and website interfaces just, you know, more intuitive and easy to use.
Yeah. And it largely, what is it, though? It's like just managed DNS, isn't it? Or do you do
DNS. So it's infrastructure as a service. So they do both DNS and email delivery.
Okay.
So transactional emails.
Cool.
Yeah,
so
very interesting
user
experience.
Possibly less fun than Etsy.
Very different use cases, certainly.
Yeah, yeah. still cool, though. And they do, and it looks like they probably have a pretty decent culture. They do, like, there's dyn.com/webperf is like this big, I guess you can talk about it a little bit, but
yeah.
They allowed you to talk and, like, you know, I don't know.
Totally.
Explain all your opinions about performance.
Yeah, they're super. I mean, DNS obviously is very closely tied to performance stuff, especially when you get into the back end. So it was huge for me to be able to do a lot of experiments and basically clean up Dyn's templates and see how that impacted performance. And so dyn.com/webperf houses my main slide deck and a number of resources around, front end performance and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's when I first, became aware of you, I guess, because I think I had blog posts. This is, probably a year or more ago, some post about like ideal page weight or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had some follow-up post that was pretty good of just kind of like talking about some real numbers about how big websites or web pages should be. And even this is going on 2.5 years ago now. And it's the problem, if anything, is a bigger deal now, like much like. The obesity epidemic in America of web pages have the same problem. Just
right.
Up and up and up and up.
You had to go there, man. Yeah.
Sad. let's see what this... Okay, anyway, that's good. So everybody, Laura, UX, performance, Etsy, Dyn, very mm-hmm. smart person. So now you know who she is as we have her answer questions for her. Somebody sent us a pretty decent joke, huh, Dave?
Yeah, no, we got a good one to kick it off with. This is from Nick Hurley, and let me cue it up here. Doop, doop, doo. Here we go.
Hey, Dave and Chris. So why did the web developer prefer using M's to REMs? Because everybody hurts?
Hey! Wow.
Waka, waka, I like
waka, 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 waka. Hey.
Yeah.
Delivery was great. Everybody hurts.
Oh, that's so good. Thanks, Nick, for sending that in. That's obviously our favorite kind of question here on the Shop Talk Show. Audio questions, that is.
So just the other day, actually saw my old buddy Kevin Hale tweeted, and he was like, "You guys, check out this the flat UI kit from Design Modo." And I was like, "Oh man, that looks so great! It's really in the trend of flat design lately. You know, buttons are just like a single color with a little bit of rounded corner on it and white text on it. You know, like that's a button in flat design. None of this fancy gradient stuff. You know, but the whole UI kit." Went on from there. You know, there's like a style for the video player and drop down menus and just everything that you think of as a design kit, like there is in Bootstrap and stuff. Maybe not quite as comprehensive as Bootstrap, but it was a very nice looking UI kit, even like checkboxes and radio buttons and stuff. And it wasn't just like a dribble shot or whatever that is like theoretically a UI kit, but it's just in Photoshop and like, okay, how am I ever going to implement that? You know? this was already implemented. It was like Bootstrap in that it was a fully functional UI kit. And I linked to it on CSS Tricks because I thought, A, it's interesting and it looks great. And I think they did a good job. And I like that they went the extra mile and made it all work. But the JavaScript on it was a little kludgy, I felt like. And I was like, maybe I'll link to it and I'll make a call out for people to kind of rewrite the JavaScript a little bit. And then like hours-ish later, you go to that their GitHub repo and it's taken down. There's been a... Yeah, what do you call it? DCMA?
Yep, cease and desist, if you will.
Right, because of a copyright infringement, and it's gone. And you could see in that copyright that the issuer of the I don't know, that reported it was a company called Layer Vault. And I believe Layer Vault is like, I don't know, it's like GitHub for Photoshop files, kind of. But I think it does a little bit more than that these days, even.
Yeah, it's kind of like, yeah, they do a lot now, but a lot of it's version control for your file system.
The design for layervault.com is awesome. They clearly have a great design team. And it does bear a lot of similarities to this UI kit. I mean, you can't look at both of those two things and, you know, clearly one of them inspired the other or whatever. Whether that constitutes actual ripoffs, I mean... You know, or what exactly is copyright violations here? One way or another, the design kit isn't there anymore because GitHub took it down. So what else do you got on this hot drama?
Well, there's a few threads. There's a thread on design news. Like it's like Hacker News, but it's news.layervault. So Layervault made their own like Hacker News. So there's like a thread on there that kind of talks about what's going on. There's also a really good thread on Hacker News.
Yeah, surprisingly, which is normally full of
just
crap,
garbage.
Like.
Right.
But the first post on Hacker News is actually pretty interesting. He summarizes it, links to all the relevant stuffs, and then makes some good points here about, like, you know, even if they did like kind of steal an icon or whatever, it doesn't quite institute a DMCA takedown notice.
Right. Right. Well, and it would appear they maybe did borrow some sources. From Dribbble.
Certainly the color palette.
The color palette is exactly the same as Layer Vault, so that's a bit unfortunate. So that would have to seem like that was taken. If you're getting 8 out of 8 colors exactly the same, it would appear you maybe stole them. But, you know, I don't know.
My favorite sentence in here was that, oh God, where is it? None of it. I can't find who said it, but I'm just going to regurgitate how I remember it, is that instead of doing it this way makes Layer Vault look crappy, I think. And most people think. They're like, oh, whatever, Layer Vault, just get over yourselves, you know. Instead, what they could have done is written a blog post and said, hey, take a look at this design UI kit. Look at how much stuff they've taken from us. And the whole tide of this thing would have went the other way. It would have been people attacking this UI kit for stealing their stuff because it would have issued a bunch of sympathy for them. For because anytime anybody posts anything on Twitter that it looks like a ripoff, people are like, why don't you, you know, yeah, I don't know, whatever. The tide goes the other way, right?
Yeah, there's two ways to respond to a ripoff. Like, say, like, cool, they were influenced by me or that person. Or you, like, say, like, fail, you stole that. Here's a lawyer. I don't know. maybe Laura, if somebody stole Etsy and made Fetsy, you'd be pretty upset.
I would certainly be bummed. Yeah.
Okay, I guess that makes sense. There's a business goal involved. I don't know. What do you? I guess I think it's really weird that you can trademark. I don't know if they trademarked like flat design. It just looks like a bunch of rounded corners, but I guess the like icon set and the color choices were very maybe too borrowed is what I think it sounds like. So I don't know.
Interesting. Well, we don't have to come down too hard on it. We have some other hot drama to cover anyway, and it regards the pinkifying of the hiring process, which we just learned was a word. You want to catch us up on that hot drama, Laura?
Yeah, absolutely. So this funny thing happened when the CTO of Etsy, Kellen Elliott McRae, gave a really great talk about how they've hired significantly more female engineers, or how they've optimized the process for hiring engineers in general. at Etsy, and subsequently have hired more female engineers, which, and he goes into a lot of really great points about why this stuff is important, what worked, what hasn't, what stuff they've tried. And while there was a lot of really great discussion around it, there was also some unfortunate, not misinformation or, but, you know, backlash, I would say, to it. So I was recently hired at Etsy, and I can speak to what the interview process was like for me, but certainly there's a ton of really amazing engineers, both male and female, at Etsy, and I'm stoked to be around them. And it's such a bummer when you see things like this on the internet, and it's, why can't we all just like get excited about increasing diversity?
Yeah.
I didn't. So they are calling it pinkifying.
Yeah. A Forbes.com article did actually.
Oh,
yeah.
Geez.
Yeah. It was. And when I read it, it seemed like the article had, misunderstood what our CTO was saying. I think that what they assumed he meant was that they changed the recruiting process just for female engineers and made the interviews, less prove to me quickly how fast you are and more, you know, basically figuring out technical skills in other ways. And they changed that process for everybody, not just women, you know? And so I think that the Forbes.com article actually assumed that they had only changed the process when they were talking to female devs, which is just ridiculous.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know,
is the article down?
The Forbes.com article?
Oh, no.
No, it's still up. Yeah, it exists. And actually, if you read the comments, there are a number of female engineers who came to Etsy via Hacker School, which is a really cool program that is actually part of the CTO's talk. And they speak to the fact that, you know, they got multiple job offers and still came to work at Etsy. They definitely didn't lower the standards during the recruiting process at all.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wild. Mm-hmm. That's
freaking rude. You should read the language in here.
Oh,
it's
it?
Pretty ridiculous.
Yeah. But our cash awards are pinkifying the recruiting process, the answer? Well, Etsy pats itself on the back. I'll be sitting here scratching my head.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
Good. With all this reverse discrimination, me as a white male will never be able to get a job at one company. Ugh. Gah.
You know, I can say
an angry white guy.
I don't know if anybody else is experiencing this in the industry, but when it comes to hiring just for developers in general, I found that, you know, fit ends up being so much more important than technical skills, just for culture, you know? And I think that Etsy does a really great job of making sure they hired for fit. When I was hired, I had, you know, the normal phone screens, the normal technical screens. And then when I came into the office, it was all about finding the edges. It was all about figuring out what I'm not good at. Which is a very interesting approach to take when you're, you know, hiring a manager, especially.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, so I don't know if you guys saw the Heroku. They had like a big WASA conference for like kind of an internal conference. And the CEO there was like, you know, I think there's only like one woman developer in the room, and that's a problem, and we need to fix that. I would like Heroku to be like, you know, influential in the change of tide for women engineers. And, you know, they even came under fire, like failed. They only had one lady. But the way I read it was like he was actually saying like, yeah, we do. And that's a problem. So we need to fix this. So I don't want to wrap you up in lady drama, but I would feel like you would agree. There's plenty of women engineers out there. And they just need to be employed. Like, companies need to hire them. It just seems like.
I mean, totally. There's so many. I mean, I've met so many really talented developers, especially when I try to host lots of like little groups, like Birds of a Feather, especially at things like Velocity, to meet more of them. And they're always so talented. And I think that when you've got a culture like at Etsy that has an 80% female user base, it's an interesting thing, you know, female engineers working for a female user base. And I'm excited to see more companies trying to tackle this issue of diversity. One interesting thing that the CTO mentioned was they've had some success putting multiple women on a team instead of having a woman in isolation on a team. So instead of just having one woman, she becomes the woman, the female engineer on a team. But when you've got two or more, you know, that solves a very interesting problem. So I'm excited to see what more learnings we get in the next year or so, you know, not just at Etsy, but really across the technology board on what works and what doesn't for getting more female engineers hired.
Yeah, that's awesome. I hope you keep, you know, or everybody there keeps writing about it too and talking about it. We have a couple of links to mention. One of them I said I would mention because it's pretty cool. I like the acronym. The acronym is FRED. And FRED stands for front-end developer. And I think, you know, front-end developer is such a mouthful these days. Maybe it'll catch on and we can start calling ourselves FREDs. Although it's a little gender-specific, isn't it? And whatever. Go to fredup.github.com. And it's, you know, it's just like a new trend of meetup. You know, it's like a bar camp or whatever. It's like meetup, but it's specifically for front-end developers, which is cool. So I said I would mention that, fredup.github.com. There's one in Buffalo, New York, Manchester in the UK, and Toronto, Ontario. Very international event already. Cool. Another thing I wanted to mention, because we talked about UA sniffing a little bit in the beginning of this episode. I think this is really cool. It's called Client Hints. Did you see this, Dave? Laura? Client Hints.
You know, I saw it and I started reading it, but it's pretty dense for me. So maybe give me the junior developer wrap.
I can't do that for you. But you know, there's headers in every request.
Sure.
We all know this, right? And part of those headers is the user agent string, which we can parse and sort of kind of figure out the device and stuff. But that doesn't tell us anything about the current like state of the browser, you know, like you have no idea what the viewport size is from a user agent string, mm-hmm. right? You don't know all that stuff that you might want to base a responsive web design on, right? Like the
current images,
screen size, the base font size, and
your CSS,
yeah, like user agent sniffing and that stuff sucks. Wouldn't it be cool if there was a standard, so instead of just sending in the head of all these requests, it wasn't just the user agent string, but it had all that information that you might want, so you can respond on the server side better. So that's what the client hints is, and I think it's a GitHub project, and it's in its whatever RFC, request for comments mode, and there's one issue in there with the discussion, and of course the Filament Group guys are like all over it because it's very relevant to the kind of thing that those guys think about and do. So there's a long conversation about like what they would like to see in there, you know, which they have just a million thoughts of, you know, Scott Gell and Wilto and Ethan Marcotte and stuff are all talking about it. I mean, they want to see stuff like screen pixel density in there. That's going to be in there. But they want to see, instead of just device size, they want to see viewport size in there too. They want to see the default font size so they can figure out if somebody's bumped their font size up or down, they can figure that type of stuff out. And it requires a lot of back and forth, because if you send over viewport dimensions, that can change like all the time. You know, you move your browser window a little bit and refresh the page. Now you're sending a different header with different information in there, which can affect on the server side what you send. There's some caching issues involved there. It's all pretty interesting stuff. But I think this is definitely the future, and we need to get off UA sniffing and onto real device capability sniffing. Mm-hmm. We can even stop calling it sniffing, possibly.
like it's Please. It's broadcasting. Yeah. You're just reading what it's telling you.
Yeah,
right? Because right now, if I want to make a JavaScript decision based on the width of the browser, I have to download the whole page and then run JavaScript and then make a decision. So there's like a blurb no matter what I do. So, I mean, if you could do that on the server side, that might be pretty great. So,
and this is Ilya from Google. So this isn't like a thing that you add to your project. This is going to be like a real thing with a real spec, and it's going to really go in Google. You know, it's not going to be something we can use right away, but this looks like it's going to happen.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Exciting times.
I should mention, because I have the tab open and I still think it's so awesome, there's a really cool Tumblr called geometrydaily.tumblr.com, and they publish cool geometric stuff. And Laura at one time made CSS3 geometrydaily.tumblr.com, where she would take the designs posted in there and recreate them with HTML and CSS. And then post them to this blog. And the last post was a little while ago.
Too long ago. It's such a nerdy site. It's funny you bring it up, because it's math is really what it comes down to. you know?
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, how did you do this?
Oh, my gosh.
Do you have, like, a math, huge math background, or what?
Okay, so my dad's actually, shout out, hey, Dad. He's an eighth grade algebra teacher. So I grew up, I could recite the Pythagorean theorem to the tune of Gilligan's Island when I was like six, even though I didn't know what it meant. So I've sort of been a little bit of a math nerd for a while. And when I saw this, and I also, by the way, hate geometries, but in some ways it comes down to math. So yeah, this was fun for me. And I actually teamed up with a couple of developers at Dyn who also used to be high school math teachers to work on it a little bit. But yeah, it's basically like either trying to hack it in Photoshop and figure out the math from A to B, or really try to get the underlying algorithm or equation that he uses to build this stuff.
This is some sick stuff.
It's just fun. And notice there's a submit button at the top, folks. So if you get inspired, submit them. I think this would be a cool place to get math. Clearly, the only failing of the site is that it's on JS Fiddle and not CodePen.
I was thinking about that as I was coming on the show, and I've. Ooh, I promise the next one will be on CodePen. How about that? I commit here that the next one will be on CodePen.
Thank God. Excellent! No, I really don't care. One. You know, but I do care. let's see. Let's get into the Q&A. We're 30 minutes in. Maybe I'll do a sponsor and then we'll do the Q&A.
Sponsor.
Is that fair? Because yeah. I want to talk about Converge SE. It's coming up April 25th through 27th in Columbia, South Carolina. Beautiful. It's the capital, right? I'm sure I've seen the capital there. It's big. It's beautiful. I'm going to be there. Big speakers that. So when we were in Orlando, me and Dave were just recently for Environments for Humans thing.
Yes.
Aaron Draplin was there, and I kind of got possibly too drunk and missed his talk in the morning because he was the first one, and I feel really bad about it because apparently it was awesome and hilarious. I met him. He's awesome and hilarious. He's going to be there. Daniel Burka from Google, who I got to hang out with in Hawaii, is going to be there. Carl Smith, who we all love, is going to be there. Jen Lucas, who is in the chat room right now, is going to be there. It's going to be an awesome time. Please come to it. It's very affordable. It's one of my favorite conferences of the year for sure. The crew at Unmatched Style does it. Gene and Gio and Jay are just such awesome people. I can't wait for Converge. Please come. ConvergeSE.com, April 25th through 27th in Columbia, South Carolina.
Yeah, you know, I've seen the Converge guys the most this year as any other year ever, and super awesome. Anyway, it's like they're the nicest freaking guys you'd ever meet. All right, well, let's move into some Q&A. We have an audio question here. So here we go.
Hi, guys. HTM Elvis here. My question today for you is regarding gzip compression. I notice you use YSlow for optimization, and one of the things they talk about is using gzip on all of your components. Do you guys know of any tools or references that I could check out just to feel a little bit better about this compression? I feel like if I use it on my client sites, I'm going to break them all into pieces. So I'd just like to hear your thoughts on gzip. Thanks a lot.
Gzip. Laura, do you know anything about it?
Oh, yeah, that's a really great question. In terms of resources, actually, I'd have to hop on Google, but obviously it can be really excellent for a number of resources. Don't use it on images, but for things like CSS and JavaScript, it can be really great.
Don't use it on images. I want to hear about that.
Yeah, well, actually, Souders, I'm going to Google this right now. Souders just tweeted about this. Let me look it up. But while I'm Googling that, I'm going to tell you that if you use CSS and gzipping on CSS, gzip is really happy if you actually put very similar lines together. Mm-hmm. So let's say you've got a lot of declarations that are sort of similar in pattern. Say lots of things with a similar vendor prefix, but with, you know, they actually...
.module.li.
Yeah, sure. Or anything, really anything that looks alike, gzip is super happy and compresses that, you know, very speedily, I will say. So you guys keep talking like for the Souders thing.
Yeah.
Okay, no, cool. I once mentioned gzip in a talk. So everybody knows what zipping is. Like you have a folder on your desktop and you right click and you say zip or whatever and it makes that folder .zip. That's not 100 miles away from what the server is doing really. It's using that same kind of algorithm. But you don't actually go on your server and zip the files yourselves. It's just it's like a setting that you tell your web server that when you send files out, zip them before you do it. And it happens so instantaneously fast. And then it comes over to the browser, you know, it traverses the internet and ends up at your browser. And your browser just knows that it happens to be a zipped resource and unzips it before it uses it. So what travels across the internet isn't, you know, style.css with all of its white space and, you know, all that fancy stuff. It's a zipped version of that CSS file. So what had to traverse the internet was a lot smaller than it would have been. And that's great for speed. That's it in a nutshell,
yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, totally, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, for images, I mean, basically, you're probably already doing a lot of compression yourself, so it's usually unnecessary to force GZIP to take some time and compress them again for you.
Okay.
And the server does it, like, so fast. It's awesome. I would say for resources or tools, my go-to is always the HTML5 boilerplates htaccess file. If you have a web server, chances are it's on Apache. So you just get this .htaccess file from HTML5 boilerplate, drop it in your website, and pretty much makes it 100% faster. If you're facts, I'm just giving away facts here. If you're on Nginx, which is kind of a newer Russian made web server, it's really awesome, but there's also configuration files the HTML5 boilerplate maintains for gzipping and stuff like that. But that's a little bit next level. Just try the Apache thing. It should work.
Yeah. I was going to explain how you, oh, there, request headers. I was going to explain how you can see if gzipping is working for sure, which you can do through the Chrome dev tools. And the request headers, it says accept encoding and then has the gzip. But it's a little hard to explain over the radio. So let's do another question instead. Dan Goodspeed asks, a few weeks ago on the show, you were asking about the pros and cons of making a separate style sheet for styles that are only used on one page. Instead of including them in the main style sheet, I know it's not common practice, but what about an embedded style sheet at the top of the HTML document, literally just a style tag? To me, that has the advantages of both. You don't load the unused style sheet on every other page, and you don't have the extra HTTP request for another style sheet. Does that make sense?
That's good. That's really good. I don't think I've actually ever benchmarked that. I mean, it must be faster because it's not getting the request. I'm not sure if it's going to stay as maintainable. Again, if you're just creating styles used on one page, you really have to ask yourself, is this okay? Because you really should always be creating things that are easily repurposable because you never know when you want to do that thing again.
Totally. Right. Mm-hmm. But they're all, you know, like that, of course, that's the solid rule. But then you find yourself all the time, you know, you just need one little thing or you're doing a little art direction on a one page basis or something or the type of thing like that. Yeah. I'd say, Dan, that's a great way to go. And certainly from a maintainability perspective, like Laura mentioned, that's weird. But that, you know, depending on how you author sites and how you deploy them and what your build process is like, there's probably a way that you can still maintain that CSS elsewhere and just kind of embed it as needed at the top, you know, like whatever your authoring world is like. This has kind of become a big thing for me. I'm going to start doing some talks on this soon. It's just that how you, you know, what ends up what ends up getting sent across the wire in the browser using is like should bear little resemblance to how you work as an author. Like you should, yeah. And I know that's a little abstract, but I don't know. Maybe I'll just leave it at that for now.
I would add if the styles are being reused, don't just spit out a code block on every page. I mean, you save the HTTP request, but it's not cacheable, or in a sense, you know, you're adding 30K or whatever to every HTML page when, you know, a line of CSS would then cache, or a link tag would cache a CSS file of 30K, you know. But for art direction, I do that all the time. I output code blocks and stuff like that. So maybe that's helps you out. I don't know, header and footer metadata.
Good idea, though, Dan. I think we're all in agreement here that that's certainly not a bad thing. Avoid an extra HTTP request. It's a good idea all the time. One less JPEG, as they say.
Ew. All right. Next question. We're good to go. Okay, good. Next is from Alex Brinkman. It's an audio question, our favorite kind of question here at the show.
It's a leader.
Hey, Dave and Chris. My name's Alex. I'm a web developer in Denver. I absolutely love the show, guys. I think you do an awesome job. I learned a ton from your show, and I appreciate it, so thanks. My question is, if you could only go to one front-end conference this year, which one would it be? I think I've got my company willing to pay for a conference, and I'm trying to figure out which one I'd get the most out of, kind of a mid-level front-end developer. So yeah, that's my question. Again, thanks for the show. Love to hear your answer.
I meant to do the Converge thing right after that as like an obvious lead-in kind of thing, but I failed in that. But certainly Converge SE is a fantastic conference that you could go to, and definitely look into that, Alex. I'm a big fan of all of Environments for Humans stuff. They sponsor the show, but I've also been going to them forever, and I love it. I was just back from Webstock in New Zealand, which was like some next level conference action. I know that might be a little hard to convince your boss to send you to New Zealand next year, but that was pretty good. And I thought I'd just throw it out to you guys. What are your kind of favorite conferences, if you have any?
The one that I find I'm inspired by most often is the Event Apart ones, just because I often go there. I don't really have a design background, and I'm just the way that they approach things, the new stuff I see there has always been really inspiring.
Yeah. Event Apart is a very good, prestigious conference here in the U.S. I don't know if they do any internationally, but they're all over the U.S., so check those out for sure.
For me, there's a Front End Conf in Florida.
That's
a good one. Front End Design Conference. I'm also Environments for Humans. You guys know these guys. They're sponsors of the show. They took us to Hawaii. That was awesome. But they have a CSS Dev Conf coming up just outside of Denver. So, and that's in October. That's kind of way out, but, I would say that was maybe from a nerd perspective, that was my favorite.
I love those ones that are like super duper specific on one topic, so you can just like deep dive.
Yeah. So I would recommend that, especially if it sounds like you're a competent front end guy. You're not just learning sort of.
You want to see, I know you asked us just for one, Alex, but you know, that's no fun. We're going to give you the whole pile. Let's do another question. We have one here from Aaron Smith.
Aaron Smith. Oh,
this is a little long. I think it's like a minute and a half, but it's, you know, it'll end up inspiring a little conversation, I think.
Everyone go get a soda. Pause the podcast. Go get soda. Come on back. Here we go.
Hey, Shop Talk. My name is Aaron, and within the past 3 months, I've taken on my very first web client. I've been doing the usual self-teaching methods, and things have been coming along very well, but the one thing I'm trying to determine is just how much third-party applications or copying of public sources is too much. I've coded my first site entirely by hand, with the exception for a Nivo photo slider, because my JavaScript skills just aren't that great yet, and I also kind of cherry-picked and dissected a 960 grid framework for responsive design and kind of just a neat little layout for CSS and HTML. Which I still need quite a bit of understanding on media queries themselves. I've heard Chris talk about WooFoo quite a bit. And so I visited the site and I created an account. Because the forms that I tried creating on the site that I have now, I just can't seem to get coded correctly, or maybe the PHP I was using to submit, you know, an email back to myself from wherever the clients would post contacts on there. I couldn't get it to work right. So I figured I would go the WooFoo route. And I guess the long story short really is, as a developer, would it be better to create my own forms and everything on a website, or is it perfectly fine to use resources that others have provided to us? How much is too much? I love the show. I can honestly chalk it up to helping me stay focused and determined to learn all I can about front-end web development. Sometimes it's tough to stay on track when you have no one to discuss things with that you learn, and it kind of helps keep the hype build up to continue learning.
And your show fills that void for me.
So once again, love the sound effects. And the podcast. Thanks, guys.
Finally, somebody who appreciates the sound effects. Gosh.
I can't believe you didn't have a sound effect for that.
Yeah. There we go. Yes. That's all I'm asking.
The root of Aaron's question was how much third party stuff is too much. And there's two ways we can approach this. And one, because we have Lara here, it might be interesting to talk about like literally third party scripts and stuff and how that might affect performance and just considerations there. And another being just like you're a designer, you're paid to build things. Like if a designer comes to you and says, "Hey, we need a website," and you like go to ThemeForest and buy a site and then go to Wufoo and build all the forms for it and go to stock photo dot whatever and buy a thing and put it in the header. Are you a designer still or what's up? And I think, I don't know. Take it to somebody.
Well, I can talk about a little bit about third-party stuff. Brad Frost has this great site about what happens when you have a single point of failure on a page, like a third-party widget. It's interesting how many sites don't realize that when you say you have a Facebook button, a Facebook like button, or the Twitter share button, or any kind of third-party provider on your page, it can cause huge performance problems, but also usability issues if that third-party provider doesn't do a good job of writing that code or if they go down. I've had multiple cases of, like, you know when you're on, like, a news site and just something doesn't look right, like the spacing's all weird, or, like, you can't read half the content, and you realize it's because they didn't put a height on the container div for their share buttons, and suddenly, like, things just become totally unusable. So there's definitely a point where you have to ask yourself, is this not performing well? You want to benchmark before and after you implement any kind of third-party widget. But also, does this have the potential of taking down my site entirely? Is this blocking content rendering? Is this not loading asynchronously? So there's definitely lots of stuff to consider, because you really have to end up relying on good code from third parties, which is a little scary.
Yeah, good summary. That's great.
Trust your vendors. That's good.
So you're looking a little bit for asynchronous stuff. Of course, Wufoo will never do this to you because it's amazing, and I wrote that embed code. So
hey-o.
Nice.
That was one of my gifts to them before I left.
Great job.
It's asynchronous, which is cool. So what you'll see is a script, and you'll see in the script injects another script. That's like your most basic way to get asynchronous action going. If you see just a script tag and it just says source and then links to somewhere that has a script at it, that's by nature more blocking and a little bit more dangerous. You can put the async tag in a script now that makes it more async-y, but of course that relies on the browser then knowing what that is and knowing how to deal with it, which doesn't help you in like old IE and stuff. But that's better. That's what we're doing for CodePen at the moment, which we could probably do a better job at, but we just like toss the async tag in there when you embed a pen. And that makes it async, kind of.
It works.
Yeah. I don't know what else is going to... I don't know. I don't know if that's exactly what Aaron was really getting at. I think he just kind of felt bad-ish that, like, you know, he needed a contact form and he tried to write one himself with PHP, but he just couldn't really get it working and just used Wufoo instead, and like has some kind of guilty complex about that, perhaps about the fact that he just used a third party thing but charged his client anyway. Do you have any hangups on that kind of thing?
I don't, but I feel like I've learned a lot of lessons doing it the hard way, so I don't want to be like, yeah, just use Wufoo. But
right,
when I talk to myself, I'm like, yeah, just use Wufoo because forms are terrible.
Let's say you made crafts. You know, let's say you were like an artist and you needed somewhere online to sell your work.
Uh-huh. Where are you going with this?
You know, would you like learn Rails and make a store? Or would you spend 10 minutes making a store on Etsy and get on with your life? Anyway, I know that's a stretch perhaps, but I was just giving another plug for Etsy there because
it's
the world's coolest website.
I think go ahead, Lauren.
No, I totally agree with you, Chris. Like, I hate forms. I really they're awful. So, like, Wufoo is perfect. I've used them in every single freelance project I've ever done. So when it comes to things like that, don't reinvent the wheel. Somebody's doing it really well, and you can totally use... I would feel totally comfortable doing stuff like that, especially for a client. Because if you can provide a better service to your client by using a third-party service, do it.
Yeah, it makes you a better designer, I think.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, even if you did it yourself, this was always my, like, I ended up giving the elevator pitch for WooFoo all the time, even though I didn't mean to, you know, and then I was like 20 minutes into it and I'm like, okay, shut up, Chris. That's what made me a good worker there, I feel like, because I was constantly explaining. Like, even if you code this form yourself and you get it working, did you do spam prevention? What happens when you want to update it? Now, do you need to, like, update the database on the back end and update the script that deals with the form fields that it's willing to accept? And what if you need to build a little logic into it? Or did you even build a database that saves the data at all? Or did you send it right to email so that, that, you know, then it's kind of dangerous. Like, you're not really collecting that information. It's like, are you dealing with the security of it? Are you, like, are you up to date on all, making it as HTML5 cool as it can possibly be? And, like, what if you need a date? Are you going to write your own date picker too? You know, like, it's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, at this point, it's like, you're not doing yourself a service. Dave's got a good point. You can learn from that. So I'm not saying never build a date picker ever, but you got to pick your battles, you know? And if you're in the business of providing final solutions for clients, you should probably use as many possible helpful third-party tools as you can.
I think I could go through the Shop Talk Show website real quick and tell you what's third-party and what's not, and just so you could get an idea. So our comments on our posts, we're using Discus mm-hmm. because... like comment forms.
What do you
and
say? That's what. Is it discuss or discuss?
Disqueeze. We're using disqueeze because it's better. It has better moderation. It's pre-styled. Styling comments is always terrible.
It's easier for the people who come there because they probably already have a Twitter account or a disqueeze account.
Disqueeze. Yes.
Or are probably already logged in. Oh my gosh, the icons are some kind of open source thing. The contact form and the ask form is WooFoo.
We were using, so here's a good example. We were using Media Element JS for our audio player, and it was working fine for like a year, but then it suddenly stopped working. So don't know why, but that's a thing that can happen with third-party stuff. And so you kind of have to know, you know, this is stuff that can happen when you're using third party. Like, suddenly you wake up and your script doesn't work and you're about to do a live show or something like that. We broadcast through a third party server. I could have set up my own Shoutcast server on some server I own, but I would rather use somebody who has already done that. And so we pay them money. And that's kind of maybe where I'm going with this. You can use services, but you might get software as a service. Like, you know, you might get your pennies stolen from you. And that's something you have to think about and bill for as a contractor. That's all I got.
One more sponsor, if you will. And then I got a good one because I want to hear something from Laura about how Etsy handles this. But I'm going to do the sponsor first. It's the Environments for Humans are doing a conference called the Responsive Web Design Summit. It's online, so you can attend it from your own house. You can even, if you have a budget for the place that you want to work and you want to bring a bunch of people from work, you can actually buy a pass that allows your whole company to sit and watch it. So if you want to, like, take a few days and, you know, buy it for your employees, there's a special ticket that you can buy to do that, which is pretty neat, and save all the everything, you know, the expensing meals and flights and all that stuff. So these online conferences are very good for people that, especially, you know, think anybody all around the world can come to these. I think it's pretty cool. Anyway, RW Summit, April 16th, 17th, and 18th, it's split into three kind of tracks. There's a day of performance, there's a day of strategy, and a day about kind of technical stuff. But you should look at all the names of the talks. Like up on day one, Estelle Weil, CSS and Mobile Performance. I'm sure it's going to be awesome. She does tons of super technical talks. And Christopher Schmidt himself is talking about responsive image techniques. Billy Hoffman's going to be there. He's been on the show before, hasn't he? We had Billy on once, didn't we?
I don't think so.
Really, Billy Hoffman? We should get him on. He's a performance dude. Where did I meet him? Maybe I just, whatever. Anyway. I
dreamed it.
Look at Trent's doing it. Are you doing it?
I thought I was. Maybe I'm here. I'm the anchor, dude. I'm the last guy.
Oh, you're on. Yeah, you're the last guy. Dave and Trent's going to be there. Anyway, it's pretty cool. So you should check it out. You get 20% off if you buy a ticket for the Responsive Web Design Summit with the code SHOPTALK. All caps. Anyway, you should go. Very affordable. Love those guys. Thanks for sponsoring the show. As always, Environments for Humans. Now, I want to do this last one on here. Maybe we'll do another one, but I just thought this would be interesting, kind of. Scotty D asks, so I was wondering what would be better for website testing for Retina. So he wants to test Retina. Does he buy an iPad that, because the current versions of the iPads have Retina displays on them, or does he go more all out and buy the MacBook Pro with Retina on it? And then he just has some kind of sub questions, but he basically wants to know where to go with that. And I bring it up because I'm kind of interested in if that comes up in meetings at Etsy. Are you guys dealing with the Retina issue?
You know, I think we are, but I haven't been in any of that yet, which I'm super bummed about because that's a really great question.
Especially for you want to do what you can for the artists who sell on Etsy to make their stuff look great, because the greater it looks, the, you know,
yeah, that, totally, the better it sells. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a really excellent question that I'm going to have to, I'll dig up the answer to and then write about it or tweet about it later, because I'm interested in knowing that.
Yeah. And it's particularly interested for you because it's user generated content. So you need to not only send it out in the proper Retina ready format and all the challenges that come with that, which are immense, but also kind of ask for images that are larger from the people, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. We do have, I think, a couple of photo editing capabilities where people can pick crop points. So we do some sort of user interface stuff regarding that, but yeah, that's a really good question about Retina.
Yeah, that's cool. I have no idea. And yeah, I didn't mean to put you on the spot necessarily,
no,
but
good.
let's say if you're a dev at Etsy or you're a manager at Etsy and you're trying to deal with this problem, and you're trying to equip the people that work under you to be able to test this kind of thing. What's the tool? Is there a way to test it without buying a Retina display, or do you just buy MacBook Pros that are Retina for everybody, or are there only Apple products? Can you buy non-Apple stuff that's Retina these days? I don't know the answer to any of these.
No, I don't either. So, I mean, obviously it depends on your company's scale, right? Like if you've got a budget for an enormous testing suite, then you want to go that way, because few things are better than bringing a device out into the wild to see how it looks in direct sunlight, to see how it performs when you're going into a tunnel, to see, you know, all those things.
Tunnel testing, very underlooked.
Well, you know, like, so you're on a train, right?
Yeah.
And you're checking your email and you go on Etsy and it's like, hey, oh no, we're about to go into a tunnel. How does the page begin to perform or slow down? You know, what are those experiences like? So I would say that getting a device is absolutely going to be the way to go. But what that device is, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know if there is any particularly right question or right answer for it. Like, if you're just a solo, you know, you should probably be basing this decision on what you need in your life. You know, it's not like this thing is just going to like sit on a shelf and be like, oh, it's Retina testing day. Better open up my MacBook, my multi-$1,000 computer to just look quick and then go back to my other computer. I mean, this MacBook Pro Retina will be your primary computer, surely.
Yeah.
So do you need a new computer, or do you literally just need it for testing? You know?
Yeah. Well, can I share one interesting thing about Retina and performance,
please,
actually? So you guys may have seen this. It came out in October, this really fantastic developer realized that when it comes to performance and images, compression amount for JPEGs matters significantly more than dimensions of images. Did you hear about this?
Yeah, I think Dave might actually have a little article about this. But
yeah.
Oh, good. But it just blew my mind that, you know, if you have, say, a Retina-sized or a Retina dimension image, you can actually probably
crap quality.
Right? Yeah, terrible compression. It's going to perform significantly better than a smaller dimension image that has better quality.
That is pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Right? I've heard,
you know, Dave.
Well, yeah, that technique is pretty amazing. There is kind of the problem that if you serve like a very gigantic image to a mobile device, like an iOS device, it will, at a certain number of pixels, no matter whether those are compressed or not, it will just stop. Like, it'll be like, too big. I don't do this. Sorry. I'm not.
Well,
because
it's a and I think I've even heard Paul talk about this, is that the act of having a browser resize the image for you despite how it looks in the end, which can be great, is a hard thing for a browser to do. It's very intensive.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you think about, like, if you resize a Photoshop doc on an underpowered machine, it's like all those nearest neighbor calculations start happening, and then it gets really awful. But I think that technique is awesome. But I guess it kind of puts us back into the same responsive pickle, retina responsive image pickle,
which is really yet to be solved efficiently.
Yeah.
And like you said, performance has so much more to do with just like wait time. It also has to do with energy consumption. There was a great study done about optimizing or compressing images on Amazon and on Facebook. I think they optimized at like 90% compression. They took all the images on each of the sites, reverted them to JPEGs, and then compressed them. And they saved like 20 to 30% of the joules of energy needed to load that site on a phone.
That's awesome.
It's crazy.
That's wild.
That's, JPEG, I don't FTW. Even... I'm going to start saving my files as FTW. what isn't there? It's not only 2x too, is it? I think Dave's article mentioned that you can kind of rock some like 1.5x and still get pretty good.
Yeah, so we've noticed like retina screens, and this may just be Apple's retina, not, you know, Microsoft's or Google's retina, but whatever they call it. That if you just give a retina device any more pixels than necessary, it actually does a really good job of abstracting that information, that pixel information, and kind of making a good quality image for just a little bit of gain. So we're using it kind of for places like, I don't know, like profile avatars and stuff like that. Something you don't want to do a picture fill. You don't want to ask Farouk Atez like for 50 different versions of his avatar or whatever. So we're using it there, kind of medium important stuff. You know, if you did it for like a hero image or something like that, that would be...
Is that a random Farouk mention?
Well, I just... He got called out on that Alista Part article.
I know. I thought you were doing it again. I'm like...
No, I just... He should just be the canonical avatar example for me.
I agree.
Now. All right. So, yeah, I just... I think you can use it sparingly. It's helpful. I will say that I have not gone the retina book route yet, but I just got a commit for the accessibility project yesterday that was like, hey, fix your icon, your favicon for retina. Here it is. I fixed it. And,
nice.
You know, that's something I had no idea. I don't think about on a daily basis, but it's a thing for real. So,
well, it's a little slow to go because I don't know. Right when Retina came out, most browsers weren't even supporting them at all. Even if you gave them one, it wouldn't use it.
Oh, okay.
But it's just, anyway.
But I mean, it's just these tiny boosts we can probably be making, you know, as we go.
I have a relevant piece of information here that I just remembered about. The Chromebook Pixel is out, and the Chromebook Pixel is $12.99 and looks pretty sweet and has a Retina display on it.
There you go.
So, and why not that?
A touchscreen Retina.
It's weird though. It. Like, how is it? Does it run? It runs like Android-ish something on it? I'm not sure.
Chrome OS. So, Chrome OS is just a browser. So,
okay.
There are computers out there that are just web browsers now.
Right. So, I wonder what you could use to code in it. Oh, wait. You could use CodePen. That would be awesome.
Hey,
although, you can't really do whole projects in it yet. I kind of want one of these things. Paul, send me a Chromebook Pixel, please.
I'm Paul, important and Addy, influential member. Paul, Addy. But guys, send this computer.
We're a little over. Do you have a blocker, Lara? Or
no,
can we do one more?
Keep going.
Okay. What do you got, Dave? You pick one.
Here we go. So Evan Huntley wrote in, I'm an aspiring front-end developer, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on what kind of skill arsenal is needed to succeed and get a position with an agency. Can you make it being a CSS expert, or is there a lot of JavaScript heavy lifting expected beyond base proficiency with jQuery? Does PHP and CMS integration come into play at all? Ha-ha.
Well, this is just the generic question of, like, how do I, like, become an employable person? Yeah.
It's a good question.
I've done a lot of hiring, yeah. So this is... It's going to sound like a cop-out, but it's not a cop-out. So I've hired a number of front-end developers. And again, I'm not an I've never worked for an agency, so I'm not sure how different it would be. But when I hire for a developer, primarily I'm looking for problem-solving techniques. So I want to see a portfolio, and I want to see skill sets, but I also want to see how they approach a problem. So if you hand me, if I give them, say, a Photoshop slice, you know, turn this into an HTML document, I also want to hear about how they approached it and what they did in the time limit provided. And I can fix coding. I can teach you how to code better, but I can't teach you how to problem solve any better. So when I'm hiring, it's really about like what is the philosophy with which you approach problems, and how do you go about solving these problems?
I don't think that's a cop out. I think that's
also CSS is great, obviously. And like, if you can give me a performance thing, then I'll give you a high five. But really it comes down to like, can you attack this in a creative way?
So how do you kind of like ask them to solve a problem and then kind of watch, or like just kind of ask them how they theoretically would solve it and see and watch their mind gears turn?
I usually like, well, at Dyn, I had a Photoshop slice. And so the instructions were, you have 4 hours, and we just trusted them that they would take 4 hours. You're not going to be able to finish slicing this, but get as far as you can. And then send us back all of your assets.
I would have finished it so hard.
So what's funny, what's great about this is like, you see a whole range of things, people who export from Dreamweaver, you see people who actually like try, you get to see what they start with, which I think is very interesting. Like, do they start with all the markup? Do they start with, optimizing the images? How do they approach it? But also I like to give the same test 3 months in. So like, they've been hired, do it again, and they will finish it in 20 minutes, you know, because like, it's not about like how well you code. It's about how much you approach a problem.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Slice up. That's pretty good. I got a, that was similar at Wufoo, that my little dumb little test was a PSD. Make it happen, yo.
Nice.
I did okay. That's great. So that you can see all kinds of stuff. So, but do you watch at all or not really? You just kind of see the end result and then judge on that.
Yeah, the end result helps us figure out whether or not we're going to bring that person in to talk in person. And then I like to give feedback during the interview. And I'm like, hey, let's take a look at this. Why did you do this way? You know, here's how see how they're going to receive feedback.
Oh, that's genius. So you can see, so if, you know, if they're like super defensive about it or something, you'll be like, okay.
Yeah. I love the developer who's like, bring it. Like, tell me what I could have done, improved or done differently.
Yeah.
I want to hire that person.
That's awesome. That's a great answer. I don't know, because you actually hire people. I've never even interviewed somebody ever for anything. So I often talk, I end up getting these questions and then I, shell out advice and then I just have not. you may want to take that with a grain of salt as somebody who's never even interviewed somebody before.
So my favorite interview question to give, actually, while I was at Dyn, Dyn has this thing called Geek Week. So for an entire week, we would let our freak flags fly. We would just celebrate our inner nerdiness. We would watch cult classics. We would go to an arcade. We would we actually had like a number of arcades in the office. We would compete. But the coolest part about it is that people could give 5 to 7 minute presentations on the thing that they were the most nerdy about. So it doesn't even have to be a nerdy topic. Somebody presented on football, you know. But my interview question would be to explain what Geek Week was and then say, if you were able to give a 5 to 7 minute presentation on a topic that you are geeky about, what would it be on? And like, that is so insightful as to like work-life balance, whether people have hobbies, you know, it's like, and how comfortable they are, you know, talking.
I'm like playing a bubble sort in linear Node.js 4.
Yeah.
You're fired.
Build this in ECMAScript 3.
Yeah, but when it comes to hiring, like, you want to be able to hang out with these people all day, you know?
Yeah,
when it comes
right.
to hiring a developer, like, you get a whole range of people.
Yeah, you want somebody that's like, I don't know, I do chalk drawings on walls, and I'm going to tell you about the three different kinds of chalk that I use. Because then they'll be certainly interesting. I know that was the weirdest example ever. But, yeah, I would totally do one. I would explain how Clawhammer Banjo works or something. I don't know, not to like impress or something, but it would just be like, yeah, I just certainly want to work with people who are interesting beyond code.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, I think a Shop Talk Show tattoo would help you. I think knowing how to integrate into a template would help you. So, yeah, and all kinds of things. Just know what you know. Be good at what you know.
And be able to say, I don't know, when you don't know something.
That, is that the most important thing? Like humility, not lying?
Yeah, because an interviewer is going to see right through you as soon as you pretend like you're just nodding and smiling as they're talking at you. You know, the ability to say, I don't know, at something is huge.
Oh, good.
That's cool. All right. Well, I think that's all we have time for today, Laura. How can people follow you, get in touch with you, give you money? How does that work?
I'm not sure about the money, but certainly Twitter, at Laura Swanson, come and say hi.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. And we know you're busy, so thanks a lot.
Thank you, guys.
And thanks, everyone, for coming out in the chat room. You guys are the greatest fact checkers in all the land. We really appreciate that. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. Subscribe in iTunes. Rate us a 5. It's just that easy. And, Chris, do you have anything else?
Very last thing.
Go, dude. You did this last week.
I know. It's so funny, isn't it? You're ready to cancel it and I screw you up. But I wanted to mention, I'll mention. Oh, did you really?
I'm just kidding.
Oh, man. That for the first time ever in Buffalo, and you can check this out, facebook.com/groups/shoptalkbuffalo. There was the very world's first ever Shop Talk meetup, which this needs to keep happening, and we need to expand it to more cities so I can come to one. But anyway, if you happen to live in Buffalo, check out facebook.com/group/shoptalkbuffalo and go hang out. Look, they have 14 members of their Shop Talk meetup group, which is amazing. Anyway, shoptalkshow.com.